and EU's plans to regulate snowmen. Created by the EU to address, in its words, Russia's ongoing disinformation campaigns, East Stratcom has discredited 2,500 stories in the 16 months since its establishment. A year after I met Ilves, I was invited to speak at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, often dubbed the Russian Davos, on a panel about government policy toward data. The panel, which included two of Putin's most senior advisors on digital policy, was addressing the question, is big data a natural asset or a commodity? As so often at these types of high-profile events, the platitudinous conversation was instantly forgettable. But had the panelists been honest, they would have invented a third category for big data in Russia. Rather than a natural asset or a commodity, big data, in Putin's Russia at least, is becoming a weapon, something that enables the perpetual waging of war on your enemies. Ilves may therefore be right in his criticism of Edward Snowden, who of course just happens to be exiled in Moscow under the protection of Putin's secret police. Worrying about individual privacy, with its now rather outdated Orwellian tropes about a Stalin-like big brother with a clear ideological agenda, might be very last century. The new nightmare is the digital vertigo created by the fact fiddlers in the Kremlin. The new nightmare is an endless misinformation war launched from the opaque depths of the Kremlin. And the only defense against this is what Ilves calls data integrity. A secure and transparent system that guarantees the reliability of information. In their book about blockchain, the open-source public ledger technology that they call the Trust Protocol, Don and Alex Tapscott observe that technology is at the heart of just about everything, good and bad, in the world today. So, Moore's Law, they warn, doubles the power of fraudsters and thieves, not to mention spammers, identity thieves, phishers, spies, zombie farmers, hackers, cyberbullies, and data nappers. In Putin's Russia, digital outlaws have found a state-sponsored home, a place that will sponsor their fiddling with all our data, from the identity of our blood type to anything else that could harm us. In an age of accelerated evil, the Russian Federation, with its $300 million annual budget to support Fancy Bear's 1,000 elite hackers, has become the world's hub of digital deceit and disorder. Estonia obviously can't fight the shadowy army employed by Putin and his cronies, but what this republic on the northwestern edge of Russia can do is offer an alternative model of a transparent, open, and fair kind of political system. One that is the antithesis of the monstrous purveyor of untruth that is emerging on its eastern border. One that prioritizes trust and is built upon the integrity of data. One, above all, that makes all of us accountable for our online behavior. You are under surveillance. That's why Estonia matters. It offers a glimpse into how to live well in cyberspace. And it's also become a model for other developing countries that are trying to create the kind of ID system Estonia has pioneered. In India, for example, the Estonian model has been extremely influential in the creation by the Modi government of a digital ID system known as Aadhaar, which is based on biometric and demographic data and is designed to give a digital identity to all 1.2 billion Indians. One of the architects of Aadhaar is Viral Shah, a Bangalore-based technology entrepreneur with a PhD in computer science from UC Santa Barbara. Like so many of the technically brilliant young Estonians I met in Tallinn, Shah has leveraged his skills as a startup tech entrepreneur to make the public sector more innovative and responsive. Together with Nandan Nilekani, the former CEO of Infosys Technologies, India's second largest IT services company, Shah was commissioned by the Indian government in 2009 to reboot India by building a low-cost data ID system that would realize, in Nilekani and Shah's words, a billion aspirations. People in India are dying to be seen by the system, the youthful Shah explains, the pre-Aadhaar India, when we meet at his club in Bangalore. If I'm a lower caste person and get picked up by the police, I have no ID, no rights, no defense. So we need, he insists, to get over the hump of identity. Viral Shah sees many parallels between India and Estonia in getting over this hump. Government is the most trusted brand in India, he explains, noting the similar political cultures in the two countries. What I love about India is that institutions work, Shah says, adding that there is a relatively high level of trust between politicians and the electorate. And the Aadhaar project, he explains, pointing to the similarities with Estonia, was used to amplify this trust. Where India can learn from European countries like Estonia, Shah adds, is on the burning issue of privacy. There's no privacy law in India, he tells me, and there's a need to build what he calls platforms of trust between the people and government. Europe is far ahead on these regulatory issues, he acknowledges. Echoing Thomas Hendrik Ilves, Shah argues that there is a need for what he calls social contract theory to reinvent the relationship between citizens and the government in the digital age. Other Indian technologists share Shah's concern over privacy. Siddharth Bhatia, a New Delhi-based journalist writing for The Wire, tells me that he's ambivalent about Neelakani and Shah's Aadhaar project. I worry, he tells me over tea in a New Delhi mall, because there are no checks on government. The New Delhi-based Arvind Gupta, the former head of the information tech unit at the ruling BJP party, also agrees. It's very important to come out with a policy that addresses the protection of privacy, Gupta tells me, if we want to be the biggest democracy in the world that is also digital. Some Indian critics of Aadhaar actually use the Estonian ID system as a model for improving the Indian one. Sunil Abraham, the executive director of the Center for Internet and Society, a research organization based in Bangalore, tells me that India has much to learn from Estonia. Over fish curry in the garden of his office, he tells me that the Estonian system is better because it's based on internet technology rather than biometrics. Moreover, Abraham adds, Aadhaar needs what he calls a decentralized authentication infrastructure, something akin to the blockchain-like solution that Siim Sikkut and Linnar Vik have constructed in Estonia, which protects the privacy of its citizens. Of course, India, with its 1.2 billion people, of whom only 35% are online, isn't Estonia. But the challenges that the two countries face as they try to reinvent themselves in the digital age, the challenges of trust and privacy, and the reinvention of a social contract between the state and its citizens, aren't dissimilar. Government not only can do good in fixing the future, Viral Shah, the entrepreneur who rebooted India to realize a billion aspirations, tells me, it has to. As one drives out of New Delhi on the way to Agra, the home of the Taj Mahal, there is a large sign on the road. You are under surveillance, it says. Estonia matters because it offers a country like India a model for establishing digital citizenship while protecting privacy rights. Estonia, where stuff happens first. But it's not, fortunately, the only place where stuff happens. There is indeed another place on the other side of the world that, like Estonia, is leading the world in digital innovation. It's an island, one not entirely unlike Thomas More's imaginary little place that resembled a grinning human skull. Chapter 5. Utopia, A Case Study, Book 2. The Smart Island. The island of Utopia, we are told by Raphael Hithloday, the fictional guide to the no place in Moore's little book, is crescent-shaped and resembles a new moon. It's possible that Thomas More got his geographical inspiration for Utopia from the archipelago of islands in the Strait of Malacca, the strategically valuable channel at the juncture of the Pacific and Indian Oceans that had attracted the geopolitical attention of all the 16th century European colonial powers. He might have even based it on a little place at the southern tip of the Malay Peninsula called Temasek. This island, also known as Singapura, meaning Lion City, was half the size of Utopia, but with the same well-sheltered waters, It lay halfway between China and India, and had been a commercial hub of Buddhist, Hindu, and Muslim traders for a millennium. That part of the world would certainly have been familiar to somebody of Thomas More's international network, with his central role in the Northern European Renaissance and his career as a lawyer and counselor to the King of England. In 1511, 5 years before More first published Utopia, the Portuguese had conquered the entire Strait of Malacca, including Singapura. A century later, the Portuguese burned the island community to the ground. This marshy, mosquito-infested island, with its 250 miles of coastline and its few hundred inhabitants of mostly pirates, was then occupied in 1819 by a British colonialist called Sir Thomas Stamford Raffles, who, in the name of the East India Company, established what he called Singapore as one of the most strategically valuable possessions of the 19th century British Empire. Our interest in the Singapore story begins in 1965, the same fateful year that Intel co-founder Gordon Moore invented his eponymous law with the establishment of the Republic of Singapore by a Cambridge University-educated lawyer called Lee Kuan Yew. Like pre-1991 Estonia, pre-1965 Singapore was an impoverished, ex-colonial backwater without natural resources, legacy institutions, international influence, or regional standing. Today, in contrast, post-colonial Singapore, like post-Soviet Estonia, has so successfully reinvented itself that it has become a byword for economic and technological innovation. The similarities between these two countries on quite different sides of the globe, one about 100 miles north of the equator, the other 500 miles south of the Arctic Circle, are uncanny. Like Estonia, Singapore is today one of the most wired countries in the world, with its 152% mobile phone penetration, the highest on the planet, and its nationwide fiber network offering universal fiber-to-home internet access of up to 10 gigs per second. That's 100 times faster than the average broadband access in the United States. In the McKinsey Global Institute's 2016 Digital Globalization Report, Singapore actually topped its connectedness league as the world's leader in the inflow and outflow of goods, services, finance, people, and data. Like Estonia, Singapore also excels on the Edelman Trust Barometer, ranking among the world's top 5 countries for public trust in institutions in its 2015, 2016, and 2017 indexes. Like Estonia, Singapore has made programming and other digital skills one of the core tenets of its highly reputed educational system. And Singapore has also become a country undefined by its natural borders, with 25% of its current territory having been reclaimed from the surrounding sea since independence. Stretching the land is the euphemism Singapore planners use to describe the island's reinvention of its geography by flattening some of its hills and recycling that earth to fill in the surrounding sea. This tiny tropical island on the southern tip of the Strait of Malacca is charting a map of the networked future that has great relevance to the rest of the world. Just as Estonia is pioneering data integrity, so Singapore is the pioneer of what it calls a smart nation. Launched by Lee Kuan Yew's oldest son and current Singapore Prime Minister, Lee Hsien Loong, in 2014, the state-directed Smart Nation Initiative is designed to transform the island into what one minister calls a living laboratory for enabling data to improve citizens' lives. In 2016, the Wall Street Journal announced that Singapore is taking the smart city to a whole new level and described the project as the most extensive effort to collect data on daily living ever collected in any city. Lee Hsien Loong is designing a city like Moore's Utopia where there are no hiding places. The utopian goal of the Smart Nation project is to record everything in Singapore, so that everything about Singapore will be known by all Singaporeans. It's an attempt to actually realize the first law of geography, to make everything connected. Singapore is deploying an undetermined number of sensors and cameras across the island city-state that will allow the government to monitor everything, from the cleanliness of public spaces to the density of crowds and the precise movement of every locally registered vehicle, explained Lee Hsien Loong at a political event in Singapore, using language that would understandably not only spook privacy advocates, who have 19th-century sensibilities about an individual's intrinsic right to be let alone, but also worry critics of Singapore's semi-authoritarian political culture. There is much for these critics, which include Amnesty International, opponents of the governing People's Action Party, and human rights groups, to worry about. In spite of all its remarkable economic achievements, the same People's Action Party has ruled Singapore without interruption since independence. While Singapore's constitution guarantees free speech, it also permits the government to control this speech with such restrictions as it considers necessary or expedient, in order to protect the privileges of Parliament, and to prevent contempt of court or incitement to any offense. And so Singapore's constitution guarantees free speech as long as what you are saying isn't deemed offensive by the governing party. It's no wonder, then, that Reporters Without Borders, in its 2015 World Press Freedom Index, ranked Singapore 153rd out of 175 nations, sandwiched between Ethiopia and Swaziland, and lower than Russia, Myanmar, and Zimbabwe. Although the Singapore government has, according to The Economist, begun expounding the virtues of thick skins with several senior ministers, including Lee Hsien Loong, openly extolling the value of naysayers and subversive challengers, the country's record on freedom of speech remains at best spotty. In 2017, for example, the Singapore Supreme Court upheld a conviction against three activists who'd been protesting against a government-administered compulsory savings scheme. Most troublingly, the three protesters, one of whom had run as an independent candidate for parliament in 2015, had been demonstrating in the country's Speaker's Corner, a space where Singaporeans are supposed to be able to express themselves without any restrictions. A May 2016 criminal case against Amos Yee, a 17-year-old blogger charged with wounding the religious feelings of Muslims and Christians under the controversial Section 298 of the Singapore Penal Code, attracted the attention of Amnesty International. 2 years earlier, Yee had been sentenced to 55 days in jail for mocking Lee Kuan Yew. Amnesty International has also taken up the cases of a couple of political activists who, in June 2016, were subjected to hours of investigation after posting something on Facebook on a day when campaigning was prohibited. Amnesty International is deeply concerned by the continued sensitivity of the Singapore government to criticism and alternative views of Singaporeans, the human rights group wrote in June 2016. Rather than a digital Big Brother-style surveillance project to enforce the views of the People's Action Party, however, the goal of Smart Singapore, at least according to the government ministers, policymakers, and technologists who are building the program, is the creation of a civic intelligence platform designed for a post-privacy age. Indeed, if the e-Stonia experiment is summarized by the prioritization of trust, then the point of the Singapore Smart Nation program, which also features an Estonian-style digital ID card system that stores an individual's personal data, can be captured by a focus on intelligence. The plan, we are told, is to reinvent Singapore so that digitized information, all those exabytes of data it produces every day, becomes the foundation of a super smart new public space for civic innovation. The plan is to erect an electronic mirror that will enable the world's most connected country to become ever more self-aware. Smart Nation is certainly an ambitious plan. As the 5.5 million Singaporeans, 82% of whom use the internet, and 64% of whom are active on social media, produce more and more data, so it will be funneled via their smartphones, smart homes, smart vehicles, smart streets, even their smart schools, into the smartest of databases. Rather than a closed governmental monopoly of its citizens' information, however, the architects of the program insist that this Smart Nation database is being designed as an open platform, dubbed Virtual Singapore, accessible to everyone, especially app-building entrepreneurs and civic technologists. If, as the American ethicist Dov Seidman says, computers represent our second brain, then this ID system is designed to be Singapore's second brain. It is being designed as the database of national intentionality, a kind of digital commons of everybody's information, on which the networked society's new operating system runs. Know thyself, the wise men of the ancient Greek city-states advised. 2,500 years later, a 21st century city-state is transforming its collective knowledge into the steersman that will guide it into the future. It's not surprising that superintelligence is the defining quality of Singapore's new digital operating system. The whole Singapore miracle is, in fact, built upon it. The city-state's founder, Singapore's King Eutropius, Lee Kuan Yew, was, according to both Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, the 20th century's smartest leader. Working without any natural advantages, Lee transformed this impoverished island on the southern tip of the Malay Peninsula into one of the world's most prosperous and orderly countries. Lee achieved what had previously been seen as unachievable, creating a one-party, paternalistic political system that combined a smart government committed to the public good and a comparatively incorruptible bureaucracy with an open, meritocratic culture of personal responsibility, hard work, and entrepreneurial innovation. What he did was use a top-down strategy of regulation, innovation, and education to create a communitarian, uniquely Southeast Asian formula constructed upon the most productive and innovative qualities of Singaporean citizens. But there were also significant costs and compromises connected to this achievement. The one shadow hanging over Lee's legacy, noted Ishan Tharoor, the Washington Post's foreign affairs writer, in Lee's obituary, was his draconian methods of sometimes stifling democracy. Under Lee, Singapore was governed as a virtual one-party state, Tharoor explains. Freedom of speech, despite slow reforms, was strictly curtailed. Intense libel laws led to the bankrupting and marginalization of opposition politicians. There is, indeed, much that Singapore's semi-authoritarian founder, Lee Kuan Yew, shares with King Eutropius, the unambiguously authoritarian founder of the aggressively legislated and highly regulated state of Utopia. Just as Lee brought many out of poverty, so Eutropius, as Moore's Raphael Hithloday reminds us, brought its rude, uncouth inhabitants to such a high level of culture and humanity that they now surpass almost every other people. But there is one vital difference between Utopia and Singapore. In Utopia's profoundly undemocratic agrarian communist system, which in some ways is more reminiscent of North Korea than of Singapore, money was completely outlawed, and nobody was allowed to own anything. In Singapore, in contrast, although the state plays an important role in the country's economic life, 80% of Singapore's population, for example, still live in government housing. The free market and the accumulation of personal wealth have always been actively encouraged, and there is a quasi-democratic electoral system, albeit controversially skewed toward the ruling People's Action Party. Today, Singapore, the most connected place on Earth, has under 2% unemployment, and is ranked as the world's second busiest port and the second easiest place on the planet in which to do business. It now has a per capita income of $90,151, making it the third wealthiest country in the world, after tax-free Luxembourg and natural gas-rich Qatar. By 2050, a Citigroup study predicts it will be the richest country in the world, with an estimated per capita income of $137,710. Singapore might not be quite utopia, but in economic terms at least, it's not far off either. Lee Kuan Yew resigned as Prime Minister in 1990 and died in 2015, and his work is being continued by his son, Lee Hsien Loong, a Cambridge University-educated mathematician and computer scientist. But the Smart City Initiative, rather than just a marketing strategy to maintain his father's legacy, is the next step in Singapore's journey from a sleepy colonial outpost to the world's most intelligent nation. The challenge of Lee Hsien Loong, who enjoys writing programming code in his spare time, is not merely to digitize his father's successful formula and transform analog Singapore into an utopia. It's also to eliminate that shadow hanging over his authoritarian father's legacy, that disdain for democracy, and ensure that the world's first smart nation is also a democratic one. Geography is power. I am having afternoon tea with the writer Parag Khanna in Singapore's Goodwood Park Hotel. It's a colonial-style building set in a lushly landscaped 6-acre garden just off Scott's Road, the downtown street named after Captain William G. Scott, a 19th-century Englishman who had been Singapore's harbor master and postmaster, as well as the owner of some of the largest plantations on the island. On an island in which everything is being perpetually reinvented, nothing in Singapore is ever quite what it seems. The Goodwood Park Hotel, for example, which was originally built by mid-19th century German settlers to resemble a Rhineland castle and was appropriated by the British and the Japanese as internment camps during the First and Second World Wars, has now been restored as the kind of idyllic British colonial estate once owned by Captain William G. Scott. "It's a quiet place to chat," Khanna had emailed me when arranging where we should meet. "The perfectly air-conditioned tea room certainly is quiet, and cool, too, compared with the noise and heat outside, the 90-degree tropical weather, the crowded streets, the construction and traffic, all the endemic movement in this relentlessly industrious island city-state." Khanna is the Singapore-based, self-described political geographer with a map obsession. His 2016 book, Connectography, tries to map a 21st-century global renaissance. Over Darjeeling tea, poured silently into fine china cups by an invisible waiter, the Indian-born, American-educated world traveler tells me why he had moved 3 years earlier with his wife and two small children from London to Singapore. "You can't understand the future," he says, sipping his tea, "without embedding yourself in Asian life." "How would this future look on a map?" I ask the author of Connectography. I think of the messages encoded in Hans Holbein's representation of utopia. It occurs to me that, like the ever-changing Singapore, maps are never quite what they appear to be. "It would be like Singapore," Khanna replies, waving his arm around the tea room, as if it were the whole island. "The geography of the future is a globally connected city." Parag Khanna is right, of course. The vertiginous map of a hyper-connected Singapore, with its liquid inflows and outflows of networked goods, services, finance, people, and data, is, like it or not, ultimately all of our futures. But we know from Singapore's ability to stretch its land that geography and the making of maps are more than just the representation of physical reality. After my tea with Khanna, I use my own rather crumpled paper tourist map of Singapore to navigate the city. On many buildings, there are flags and placards celebrating the 51st anniversary of independence from Britain. "Happy birthday, Singapore! Powering the nation," these civic birthday cards all say. I take the gleaming metro downtown to the heart of Singapore, the Colonial District, the Marina Bay neighborhood down by the old quays beside the waterfront. It is here, amid its glittering collection of international banks, luxury hotels, and shopping centers, that Singapore's mastery of physical geography, its taming of nature, can be seen at its most grandiose. You can stroll in the gardens by the bay, the billion-dollar botanical gardens of the future, a conservatory featuring 217,000 plants from 800 species, including a grove of futuristic super trees, and a recreated mountain, complete with waterfall. And it's here you can shop, gamble, and sleep in Singapore's most iconic contemporary building, an $8 billion casino and hotel called Marina Bay Sands, a 21st century wonder of the world that looks like something out of a science fiction movie. A cruise liner held up by three skyscrapers, 636 feet in the sky. My destination, however, is in the shadows of the main Marina Bay Sands building. Overlooking the waterfront, nestled like an overlooked shrub from the gardens by the bay, is a small semicircular white building with 10 finger-like extensions and a bowl-shaped roof, designed to represent the white petals of an open flower. This uniquely shaped edifice resembles one of the island's indigenous tropical plants, a giant white lotus. Yet there is nothing indigenous about this building. Designed by Moshe Safdie, the same illustrious Israeli-Canadian-American architect who created the Marina Bay Sands, and also, more incongruously, Israel's Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum, it is Singapore's Art Science Museum, the city-state's leading venue for technology exhibits and festivals. I've come to the museum to see an exhibition entitled Big Bang Data. It's the history of Lee Hsien Loong's Smart Nation project to master Singapore's virtual geography. Given that nothing in Singapore, especially its giant white lotus-shaped building, is ever quite what it seems, I'm here to try to distinguish the reality from the appearance of the Smart Singapore program. The question I want to answer is simple. Is Singapore's second brain, this whole-of-the-nation endeavor to aggregate all its information in a centralized database, the solution or the problem for the future? Is it a living laboratory for a big data utopia, or is it a dystopia? Digital communitarianism. The Big Bang Data exhibition is ambivalent about the impact of data on society. On the one hand, it is full of warnings of mass surveillance, the overwhelming flood of online personal information, and the destruction of privacy. But the exhibition is also optimistic about the way in which data might enrich democracy and public participation. There are many different maps of Singapore, enough maps to satisfy even Parag Khanna, showing how the smart island is collecting and storing data in the cloud, as well as providing more and more affordable access for its 5.5 million citizens. In a section of the exhibition titled Data for the Common Good, there are demonstrations of local Singapore apps designed for the public benefit. One, called Beeline, is a free transit app that seeks to improve the lives of commuters in Singapore by enabling the sharing of real-time data. A second app, developed by the Ministry of Health, involves ways that open data sharing can facilitate communication between citizens and their doctors. A third, MyENV, created by the National Environment Agency of Singapore, offers real-time information about local air quality, weather, and dengue clusters. I have been tipped off about the exhibit by Jacqueline Poe, the managing director of the Infocom Development Authority of Singapore, the agency that is facilitating the development of the Smart Nation project in the education, healthcare, taxation, transportation, and social services sectors. Over breakfast the previous day, Poe had advised me to go to the Art Science Museum because she promised it would give me an insight into what she described as a new era in the inclusive way that technology is being delivered to the citizens of Singapore. Poe, a petite woman in a smart red dress whose only visible concession to digital technology is the jet-black Apple Watch she wears on her wrist, explains to me this new inclusive era. She expresses a vision of Singapore's digital future in the democratized language of a Silicon Valley visionary. She explains her agency's championing of open data platforms and hackathons that leverage smart Singapore information for the common good. She boasts about civic hacking and the co-creation of apps between citizens and government. She tells me about Singapore's free crowdsourced My Responder app developed by the Civil Defense Force, which enables the public to both report and respond to cases of cardiac arrest happening on the street. And she explains the importance of data.gov.sg, the Singapore government's one-stop portal for the sharing of data sets from 70 public agencies. But in contrast with the typically libertarian ideology of Silicon Valley, which fetishizes the free market and is deeply hostile to any governmental participation in the economy, Poe sees virtual Singapore as an opportunity for citizens and the authorities to work together on projects that benefit both public and private interests. Whereas the seductive ideals of sharing, collaboration, and community are often appropriated by such successful Silicon Valley companies as Facebook to further their own intrinsically private goals, in Singapore, these ideals fit naturally with the political culture created by Lee Kuan Yew. Jacqueline Po is an example of the sort of enlightened policymaker who is generating trust in the system. The daughter of a policeman, "We started out poor," she tells me. Po studied politics, economics, and philosophy at both Oxford and Cambridge universities as a state-sponsored scholar before entering government service. She speaks about her responsibility to the community, citing what she describes as the social justice ideas of the American philosopher John Rawls. She's inspired by Rawls's thought experiment of a veil of ignorance, which, she says, convinced her of a moral responsibility to look after the less fortunate members of society. Thus, her support for Singapore's national broadband network, with what she calls its comprehensive fiber-to-home service for all citizens. And thus her pride in introducing the Home Access Initiative for the lowest income households in Singapore, a program that for just over $4 a month gives these households not only high-speed internet access, but also a free smartphone. Po is far from the only civil servant in Singapore able to express her commitment to legislating the public good in the language of the Enlightenment. In the final room of the exhibition, there's another message, a kind of concluding poem for Smart Singapore, projected onto the wall. "When the smart nation speaks, I'd like to think that it is able to tell you stories for what that future might look like." Aaron Maniam, poet and director of industry at the Ministry of Trade. The next day, I visit Aaron Maniam at the Treasury office in a downtown building adorned with "Happy Birthday Singapore, Powering the Nation" banners. Like Po, he's a smart young Singaporean from a typical middle-class family. His father was an air traffic controller who won a government scholarship to study overseas. And like Po, Maniam studied politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford. He then spent a year at Yale and plans to go back to Oxford to write a doctoral thesis about the relationship between trust and technology. "What," I ask the wiry, mustachioed young civil servant, "does data mean to you?" "It means," Maniam answers, "the potential to bring a community closer together. And it means," he adds, "the possibility to deepen the trust between the government and its citizens." Like Po, Maniam is interested in the philosophy of John Rawls, but he's also well-versed in the work of communitarian thinkers such as Harvard University's Michael Sandel and the Scottish political philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre, who both prioritize the idea of the community over individual rights. Maniam tells me that he's particularly interested in the role that networked technology plays in building trust in the community and establishing a more interactive kind of democracy. Trust forms the basis of what he calls social capital that enables human flourishing. He reminds me of Singapore's high standing in the Edelman Trust Barometer and cites what he describes as deliberative platforms, like Salesforce's Chatter, which create a cooperative community of like-minded people. He imagines a public version of Chatter designed as a community forum throughout Singapore. "I like to think of it as a commons," he says, using 16th century English history to imagine the future of 21st century Singapore. It would be like the one Henry VIII closed in his destruction of the monasteries in 16th century England. So, the smart nation for Aaron Maniam, as it is for Jacqueline Po, would be a digital commons for the co-creation of civic technologies that would form the basis of an interactive type of 21st century technocracy. The sharing of data would be the foundation of a collaborative or communitarian style democracy, a digital upgrade in both form and function of the uncorrupt, quasi-democratic one-party system established by Lee Kuan Yew and maintained by his son, Lee Hsien Loong. That's the story they both imagine of what the future will look like. Trust, trust, trust. Though they are separated by several oceans and thousands of miles, it's striking how similar, in many ways, the thinking of senior public policymakers in Singapore, like Manium and Poe, is to that of their contemporaries in Estonia, like Taavi Kotka and Andres Kut. What they all agree upon is the central role that trust will have in our post-privacy age. This view is shared at the very highest level of government, too. Even Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong believes that trust between citizens and government is the key to the success of his Smart Nation project. People must be convinced that this is good for them, he says of the 65,000 cameras that have been installed in public areas in Singapore since 2012, that they will benefit from it, and it is not to intrude on their privacy. Lee Hsien Loong seems to be succeeding in this goal of building the trust of his citizens. In my time in Singapore, everybody with whom I spoke, from venture capitalists to startup entrepreneurs to policymakers to technologists to the loquacious Uber drivers who drove me around the smart island, expressed an abiding, sometimes even almost eerie, trust in the government. Maybe that's because, as Chin Lim, the Singapore-based government affairs director at the Bay Area software company, Autodesk, told me, the government has choreographed a 51-year miracle in the creation of a high quality of life, excellent education, and a plethora of jobs for its citizens. There's no hidden social contract in Singapore, Lim told me. To earn its responsibility, the government has always been accountable. According to Jacqueline Poe, this trust emanates from the shared experience of the remarkable half-century journey that Singaporeans have collectively taken. We all grew up together, the state policymaker says, describing a country in which public servants like herself and Aaron Manium seem to trust Singapore's citizens as much as these citizens trust them. Yes, this is the official line of the one-party regime in Singapore, and yes, there are some on the island, Amos Yi, for example, the teenage blogger jailed for mocking Lee Kuan Yew, who would strongly disagree. But Singapore, in spite of its shadow of one-party authoritarianism, remains a trustworthy place. It ranks high on the Edelman scale. Citizens generally trust the government to look after their best interests. So, is the Singapore Smart Nation model, with its ambition to take data collection to a whole new level, the solution to or the problem for our digital future? It depends. As with Moore's Utopia, one is simultaneously impressed and chilled by this island city-state. The challenge is institutionalizing trust and creating what Estonian President Tomas Hendrik Ilves calls a new Lockean social contract between government and citizens. And it's here that Singapore can learn from the Estonian model, with the guarantees of data integrity built into the system by technologists like Taavi Kotka and Andres Kut. Without this kind of institutional defense against untrustworthy government, the living laboratory that Singapore is creating could represent the foundations of a big data dystopia. After all, what happens in a hyper-connected society when trust between government and citizens is broken? What happens when an untrustworthy government knows everything about us? Most chilling of all, what happens if that government is not only untrustworthy, but also untrusting, so that the very citizens it is supposed to be representing are all viewed as potential enemies? Why 2020 might be 1984. The big, big elephant in the room is the protection of privacy and ensuring security, acknowledges Vivian Balakrishnan, Singapore's Minister of Foreign Affairs and the minister in charge of the Smart Nation project, referring to the way that the big bang of data can undermine individual rights. In the Smart Nation, Balakrishnan says data integrity is essential. Without it, there can be no individual freedom in the digital age. But when it comes to privacy, that elephant might not even be on the island of Singapore at all. Just as the antitheses of innovative Estonia are the state-funded militias of the fancy bears with their $300 million annual budget on its eastern border, So the dark side of the smart nation may lie to the north of the Strait of Malacca, in the People's Republic of China, a country with 730 million internet users, and an untrusting and untrustworthy ruling class headed by President Xi Jinping. The problem is that Singapore's smart nation idea, with its aggregation of its citizens' personal data, might now be implemented by a totalitarian state without any respect for individual liberty. The problem is that China is seeking to create a smart national database where all intelligence will lie with the state rather than with the individual. In contrast with Putin's Russia, Xi Jinping's China isn't an outlaw nation in today's hyper-connected new world, whereas Russia's only real innovation is the fake news it anonymously exports to the rest of the world. China is one of the world's two leading innovation superpowers, with several indigenous winner-take-all internet companies that, in its own market at least, are crushing major Silicon Valley brands. Although part of the reason for this is a tightly regulated domestic market that discriminates against foreign companies, some of the success of these local internet companies, what The Economist calls China's tech trailblazers, is related to the success of its own innovation ecosystem. China's dominant mobile messaging service, WeChat, for example, has so elegantly combined email, free video calls, and instant group chats that equivalent American products, such as Facebook Messenger or Apple Messages, now appear slightly archaic. China's e-commerce leviathan, Alibaba, and its successful microblogging website, Sina Weibo, have also added a selection of original features to make those products more popular in China than Twitter or Amazon. Uber, in fact, failed so dismally in China that it sold its local unit to its biggest indigenous rival, Didi Chuxing. So the problem isn't about a lack of Chinese innovation. Instead, it lies in the way that this innovation is being manipulated by Chinese politicians and internet policymakers, the local equivalents of Singapore's Lee Hsien Loong, Jacqueline Po, and Aaron Manium. In contrast with the relatively enlightened and trusting digital strategies pursued by officials in Singapore, China's official internet policy is censorious, punitive, and both untrustworthy and untrusting. The building of the Great Firewall of China, for example, has established a narrowly censored internet in which tens of thousands of foreign websites are blocked by the Golden Shield, a censorship and surveillance project run by China's Ministry of Public Security. As in Russia, China has a not-so-secret 2 million-person army composed mostly of government employees who flood social media with up to 500 million pro-regime comments a year. The Chinese government sometimes even shuts down hostile websites using the Great Cannon, a tool specifically designed to launch distributed denial-of-service attacks. All too often, the Chinese government's heavy-handed attempts to solve its digital problems turn out to be even worse than the problems themselves. In response, for example, to the problem of youth internet addiction, a particularly serious affliction in China, the government created 400 brutal rehabilitation boot camps that treated teenagers with electroshock therapy and other equally cruel punishments. In the preceding chapter, I suggested that the Orwellian trope of a Stalin-like Big Brother is now outdated. But I'd overlooked China, where Orwell's 20th century warnings about a 1984-style intrusive ideological dictatorship have acquired a 21st century digital form. The idea began in 2010 with local Communist Party officials in Suining County in the Jiangsu province north of the Chinese city of Shanghai. The local government began to award people points for good civic behavior and deduct points for everything from traffic tickets to illegally petitioning higher authorities for help. The points were then tallied, and people were placed into reputational tables to determine their civic reliability. If you rated highly, you would qualify for fast-track promotions at work or for access to public housing. If not, you were unlikely to be promoted, find a new home, or even qualify for official social security support. In late 2016, the Chinese authorities published a plan to establish a much more ambitious social credit system that, in the Ministry of Truth-style language of the Communist Party, would build a culture of sincerity and a harmonious socialist society. Launched in 36 local governments across China, as well as with 8 private technology companies, and aided by increasingly sophisticated facial recognition technology, this new initiative, called Internet Plus, is designed to collect the information of the 730 million Chinese Internet users into regional databases that will determine their individual trustworthiness. The official goal is to unite all these different databases by 2020, creating a national social rating system that will rank individuals according to their online data. Presumably, Internet Plus, like the 2010 Suining County pilot project, will reward loyal citizens and punish those who are deemed, by China's intended second brain, to be politically troublesome or unreliable. The data-engineered caste system in the China of 2020 will no doubt be made up of 2 groups, the trustworthy and the untrustworthy. As Chinese officials put it, by 2020, this system will allow the trustworthy to roam everywhere under heaven while making it hard for the discredited to take a single step. The underclass, to remix Marx, will have nothing to lose but their bad ranking. Trust, trust, trust. Just as the communitarian thinking behind Singapore's Smart Nation initiative is to increase the trust between citizens and their government, so the logic behind China's Internet Plus scheme is to tighten the grip of the Communist Party on society. In October 2016, President Xi Jinping called for innovation in social governance that would heighten the capacity to forecast and prevent all manner of risks. Rather than the creation of trust, the point of Internet Plus, which The Economist describes as a digital totalitarian state, is to punish untrustworthiness. To add to the Orwellian nature of this networked dystopia, individuals will be able to enhance their trust scores by informing on the untrustworthiness of others. Thus, Internet Plus will, according to China's elite state council, forge a public opinion environment that trust-keeping is glorious, and at the same time reward those who report acts of breach of trust. The most trusted, then, in this surreal system, will be the most untrustworthy. No wonder one Hong Kong human rights activist told the Wall Street Journal, "It's just like 1984. And yet in Singapore, similar technology is creating an entirely different future. There's an important lesson here. It is a reminder that fixing the future is, for the most part, a political and social challenge, rather than just a technological one. Technology doesn't solve technological problems. People do. Only humans can make their own digital histories. And this mostly happens, for better or worse, through governments. Some are mostly untrustworthy, as in China. Others are more trustworthy, as in Singapore. When the Smart Nation speaks, I'd like to think that it is able to tell you stories for what that future might look like." These were the poetic words of Aaron Manium in the last room of the Big Bang Data exhibition. But no nation, smart or otherwise, really speaks in a collective Rousseau-like voice. Nations elect or appoint smart people, like Manium, or the Estonian president, Toomas Hendrik Ilves, to speak on their behalf. Thus, the most realistic stories about the future often come from legislators or regulators. And so it's to another prescient public official we must go next to get her story on what the future might look like. But she is located on the opposite side of the globe from Singapore, in Brussels, the European capital of regulation and legislation. If Estonia and Singapore are, in their own different ways, countries in the cloud, then Brussels, with its gargantuan EU buildings filled with bureaucrats, is a place very firmly rooted on Earth. It's time then to come down from the clouds. Time to talk to the regulators. Chapter 6. Regulation. Reincarnating Teddy Roosevelt. I've flown from Northern California to the unloved, unlovely EU capital to meet the unlikeliest scourge of the Horsemen of the Apocalypse. A 49-year-old Danish woman who grew up in a small town on the flatlands of West Jutland. Her name is Margrethe Vestager, and this former deputy Danish prime minister is now the European Commissioner for Competition, Silicon Valley's antagonist. More than any other single individual in the world today, Europe's antitrust chief is standing up to the business model and business practices of what, you'll remember the New York Times' Farhad Manjoo calls, the Frightful Five, the dominant winner-take-all tech companies whose collective $2.3 trillion valuation makes up an astonishing 14% of the entire $16.5 trillion GDP of the 28 members of the European Union. According to the Financial Times, columnist Philip Stevens, Margrethe Vestager is the woman who is saving digital capitalism from the digital capitalists. The problem with free market capitalism, digital or otherwise, Stevens says, is its natural and perhaps even inevitable tendency toward winner-take-all monopolies. Unconstrained, enterprise curdles into monopoly, innovation into rent-seeking, Stevens argues. Today's swashbuckling disruptors set up tomorrow's cozy cartels. Thus, his portrayal of Vestager as someone with the potential to be the 21st century version of Teddy Roosevelt, the U.S. president who deployed the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act against industrial winner-take-all leviathans of the late 19th century, such as Standard Oil and the American Tobacco Company. But Roosevelt, Stevens reminds us, was no more of a socialist than Otto von Bismarck, the 19th century German chancellor, who laid down much of the groundwork for the modern welfare state. Rather than the redistribution of wealth, Stevens explains, the trust-busting Roosevelt recognized that capitalism required legitimacy and would thrive only if people had faith in a system that was fair to everyone. This was the same Teddy Roosevelt, you'll remember, who signed the Meat Inspection Act of 1906, one of the major pieces of legislation that, so to speak, cleaned up the meatpacking districts of New York and elsewhere. Roosevelt, like some of the other political fixers in this book, busted trusts in order to create trust. He made people believe once again in free market capitalism. The whole point of trust busting was to level the playing field for large and small entrepreneurs alike. Speaking in 1911 in support of a bill that would have set genuine limits on the size of corporations, the future American Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis observed, "There used to be a certain glamour about big things. Anything big, simply because it was big, seemed to be good and great. We are now coming to see that big things may be very bad and mean." Most of all, Brandeis, who, you'll remember, also championed the right of the individual to be let alone by what he saw as the invasive technology of photography, believed that the excessive concentration of economic power in an America of Standard Oil and U.S. Steel was antithetical to democracy. "We must make our choice," Brandeis warned. "We may have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both." Like Teddy Roosevelt, Louis Brandeis and the many other early 20th century Americans who reformed their industrial economy to make it fair once again for the small business person, Margrethe Vestager is trying to rebuild trust in the economy. It is too soon to pass Roosevelt's mantle to Ms. Vestager, Stevens admits, but everyone who supports the liberal market economy that made possible the success of Apple, Google, and the like should be applauding her courageous effort to reset the balance. Vestager's courage has been her unwavering determination to squarely stand up to what Farhad Manjoo calls the new superclass of American corporate might. By reminding companies like Google and Apple of their responsibilities in the real world, Philip Stevens suggests, Vestager, as it happens, the mother of three young girls, is socializing these often rather childish exponents of radical disruption. Apple's CEO Tim Cook, for example, often sounds as if he believes his company should be free to decide how much it pays in tax, Stevens notes. And Vestager hasn't been shy about explaining to Cook his grown-up obligations. thus her imposition of a 13 billion euro fine on Apple in back taxes for what Stevens describes as the company's